The top stories, the Syrian military says Israel has carried out a missile attack on an area in the country's southwest, causing some material damage. The war of words escalates between Russia and Ukraine as the two sides blame one another for the current crisis in eastern Ukraine. Also ahead, the U.S. and the EU announce new sanctions on Russia in reaction to Moscow's move to recognize the independence of two regions in Ukraine. Welcome to the program. The Israeli military has once again carried out a missile strike against Syria. Earlier, our correspondent in Damascus, Mohammed Ali, joined us to give us the details.
An official military source here in Syria confirmed that there has been an attack and said that about 12:30 a.m. local time, the Israeli enemy, and I quote, carried out an aggression, launching a number of surface-to-surface missiles from the direction of the occupied Syrian Golan and targeting some military points for the Syrian army in the vicinity of Al-Quneitra in the southern part of Syria. And this attack led to caused some material damage. Now, this is the third Israeli attack just this month. The previous ones targeted the vicinity of Damascus. Definitely, this is not a surprise for the Syrian army or the Syrian government, because this has been happening since the start of the crisis. And almost every time there's an attack, Syria makes sure to send letters to the United Nations to inform them and stress that such attacks are in direct support of the remaining terrorist groups in Syria, because those attacks aim to undermine the Syrian army's capabilities in fighting terrorism on the ground. So definitely this is not a surprise. Definitely Syria always stressed that this is, of course, this undermines Syria's sovereignty. It is against international law and the UN Charter. However, we still see international silence over repeated Israeli attacks.
A 14-year-old Palestinian boy falls victim to Israeli atrocities in the occupied West Bank. According to the Palestinian Health Ministry, Mohammed Shahada was fatally shot in the town of Al-Khadr near Bethlehem. He sustained injuries during a confrontation between a number of Palestinian youth and Israeli soldiers raiding the area. According to Palestinian media, Mohammed was denied immediate medical care after getting shot. Instead, he was detained by Israeli forces. The news of the teenager's death comes hours after regime forces attacked a young Palestinian boy suffering from Down syndrome in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood of occupied Al-Quds. The boy, identified as Muhammad Ajluni, was brutally attacked along with other residents. They had gathered in solidarity with the families threatened with expulsion from their homes. According to eyewitnesses, the crackdown left a number of people injured. Palestinians have long been voicing their anger at Israel's forced expulsion from their ancestral homes, as well as the regime's demolition drive in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds. Israeli forces have intensified their crackdown on Palestinians protesting against the regime's atrocities in Sheikh Jarrah and other neighborhoods. Well, Palestinians in the Gaza Strip have marched to drum up support for Al-Quds as they mark the 53rd anniversary of the Democratic Front for the Liberation of Palestine. Ashraf Shannon is in Gaza.
Under a sea of red flags, the Democratic Front for the Liberation of Palestine, DFLP, held a big protest to mark its 53rd anniversary and support Al-Quds. People thronged the streets of Gaza City to take part in the event. Protesters shouted slogans against the Israeli regime and vowed to stand with Al-Quds. Tensions heightened across the Palestinian territories in mid-February when Israeli forces and illegal settlers renewed their attacks against Palestinians in Al-Quds' Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood.
53 years on, the DFLP continues to hold sacred the liberation of Al-Quds and the right of return. and we will call on all Palestinians to protect Sheikh Jarrah.
The Democratic Front for the Liberation of Palestine refuses to recognize the Israeli regime and maintains armed resistance as the only way to end the Israeli occupation.
Resistance is the best way to liberate Al-Quds, and we say to our people in Sheikh Jarrah that we always support them. We are willing to sacrifice our lives for the sake of defending Al-Quds and all of Palestine against the Zionist enemy.
DFLP activists called on all Palestinian factions to increase armed resistance against the Israeli regime and its forces. Protesters also slammed Arab countries in the Persian Gulf region for normalizing their relations with Tel Aviv.
All those countries who normalized their ties with Israel are stabbing the Palestinian people in the back and hurting our cause. Israel is using normalization as a pretext to increase its violations in Al-Quds.
Palestinians stress that Al-Quds will always remain the capital of Palestine despite the U.S. and Israeli plots to change its status.
As they mark the 53rd anniversary of the DFLP, Palestinians in Gaza say they will continue to resist the Israeli occupation until the liberation of Al-Quds. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Tensions over Ukraine reach a crucial moment. Russian President Vladimir Putin ratifies the friendship treaties with the two self-proclaimed People's Republics of Donetsk and Luhansk in eastern Ukraine. The move comes after Parliament approved the recognition of the two breakaway regions earlier on Tuesday. The Upper House of Parliament has also approved a request by Putin to deploy armed forces abroad. Moscow says the move is aimed at sending peacekeeping missions to Ukraine's breakaway regions. Russia has also announced a decision to evacuate its diplomatic staff from Ukraine to, quote, protect their lives. Meanwhile, President Putin underlined that the Minsk peace agreements on Ukraine do not exist anymore, accusing Kyiv of killing them off.
The Minsk agreements were killed long before yesterday's recognition of the People's Republics of Donbass, not by us, not by representatives of these republics, but by the current Kyiv authorities.
Minsk agreements are a set of international agreements signed in 2014 and 15 to bring an end to the fighting between Kyiv and pro-Russian forces in the Donbass region. However, Russia accuses the Western-backed government in Kyiv of committing genocide against the residents of that region. The U.S. imposes new sanctions on Russia as Moscow orders troops into the breakaway regions of Donetsk and Luhansk in eastern Ukraine.
We're implementing full blocking sanctions on two large Russian financial institutions, VEB and their military bank. We're implementing comprehensive sanctions on Russian sovereign debt. That means we've cut off Russia's government from Western financing. It can no longer raise money from the West and cannot trade in its new debt on our markets or European markets either. Starting tomorrow and continuing in the days ahead, we'll also impose sanctions on Russia's elites and their family members.
Biden described the peacekeeping mission as the beginning of a Russian invasion of Ukraine. He also authorized the deployment of additional forces and equipment to the Baltic region. Biden said the West is united in defending Ukraine against what he called Russian aggression. Separately, the White House said a possible summit between the U.S. and Russian presidents is now out of the plans. The American Secretary of State has likewise canceled the meeting with his Russian counterpart. Meanwhile, Ukraine is considering severing diplomatic ties with Russia. The country has also drafted reservists, despite ruling out a general mobilization.
There is no need for the general mobilization today. We need to bring up to full strength the Ukrainian army and other military units in a speedy fashion. As Commander General of the Armed Forces of Ukraine, I issued a decree to recruit reservists during a special period.
Zelensky accused Russia of preparing for military aggression but played down prospects of a large-scale conflict. He called on his Western allies to quickly impose sanctions on Moscow. The West has already imposed a raft of sanctions on Russia. And the most significant of such measures, Berlin has frozen the multi-billion dollar Nord Stream 2 pipeline project, which is to carry Russian natural gas to Germany. EU foreign ministers have also unanimously agreed on, quote, an initial sanctions package against Moscow. The Russian foreign ministry has slammed the West's sanctions as illegitimate. Iran, meanwhile, has called on all sides to exercise restraint. warning against any measures that could further escalate tensions. The European Union agrees on a new package of sanctions against Russian politicians, business operators, and media outlets over moves by Moscow to grant independence to two regions in eastern Ukraine. Our correspondent Jerome Hughes reports from the EU's de facto capital, Brussels.
EU Foreign Affairs ministers held emergency talks on Tuesday to agree on sanctions against 351 Russian legislators who voted to give independence to two regions in eastern Ukraine. The West claims it's the beginning of an invasion. Russian financial, business and media outlets are also being singled out by the EU.
We agreed to target 27 individuals and entities who are playing a role in undermining or threatening Ukrainian territorial integrity.
The measures will result in asset freezes and travel bans.
We're limiting the Russian government's ability to raise capital on the EU's financial markets.
A new gas pipeline from Russia to Germany will, for now at least, remain closed. This despite the EU desperately needing Russia's energy. Citizens passing by the European Commission, the EU's executive arm, have clearly been following developments closely.
Ukraine, of course, has been generated as a state during the Soviet period, but in a way she consists of several areas which are very difficult to be maintained together.
Yeah, we need peace. Our economy is based on international trade, and gas is one of our main tools to survive.
The European Commission confirmed on Tuesday EU gas reserve storage tanks are currently only 30% full. The Commission is actively trying to secure alternative supply chains in order to reduce the EU's dependency on Russia. It's in contact, for example, with Japan, South Korea, Qatar, Azerbaijan and Egypt. But this is a very costly process because the energy has to be shipped in. Russia's gas is cheap and, of course, the pipelines are already in place. NATO, which has its headquarters here in Brussels, continued to ramp up the anti-Russia rhetoric after the new sanctions were announced.
We have over 100 jets at high alert, and there are more than 120 Allied ships at the sea from the high north to the Mediterranean.
Many analysts say this crisis could have been avoided if NATO had listened to Russia's legitimate security concerns. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The Iranian president says Tehran and Doha will take steps to facilitate bilateral trade ties. Ebrahim Raisi said Iran and Qatar have signed 24 new memorandums of understanding. He has also noted that Qatari entrepreneurs have expressed willingness to invest in Iran. Raisi was speaking in the Iranian capital after returning from the sixth summit of the Gas Exporting Countries Forum in the Qatari capital. Earlier, while in Doha, he slammed U.S. sanctions on the oil and gas industry of some member states.
The sanctions imposed by the U.S. against the oil and gas industry and also members of the gas producing countries, using this tool of sanctions for imposing one's wishes, for imposing one's domineering wishes, will fail in the face of independent countries. This will jeopardize the interests.
Mr. Raisi called for further cooperation among GECF members to bypass those measures. He said collaboration among the member states can bring about better economic conditions for them all. Mr. Raisi described natural gas as a secure source of energy which provides more economic advantages than alternative sources. The Iranian president noted that the Islamic Republic intends to play a key role in the global natural gas market, using its vast reserves and strategic geographical position. He added that Tehran seeks to increase its export and boost its cooperation with other countries in this field. Iran's top diplomat says it is now the turn of the Western participants in the Vienna talks to show initiative and flexibility.
So far, we've taken lots of initiatives and shown the required flexibility at the Vienna negotiating table. If today we're saying we're closer than ever to a deal, it's because we've informed the Americans via intermediaries, and three European countries have been told by my colleagues in Vienna or by myself through telephone conversations or during meetings with foreign ministers of these three countries. We're saying very clearly to them that now it's your turn. It's time to see initiatives and flexibility from the Western side.
Amir Abdullahian said a final deal can be reached in a matter of hours if the Western side adopts a realistic approach. He said Tehran will continue to negotiate in earnest with the aim of achieving a good agreement. Amir Abdullahian criticized France, Germany, and the United Kingdom for failing to honor their commitments under the 2015 deal known as the JCPOA. He also questioned Washington's claim of showing goodwill towards Iran as it continues to impose the country with sanctions. Meanwhile, Iran's top security official says the country's peaceful nuclear program must continue to act as, quote, the sword of Damocles against the countries that break their promises. Ali Shamkhani said the program will be a real and inherent guarantee that those countries honor their commitments. The non-aligned movement, NAM, calls on countries that impose unilateral sanctions to immediately put an end to these sanctions, effective immediately. Iran's deputy ambassador to the United Nations made the call on behalf of NAM in a statement before the Special Committee on the UN Charter. The movement expressed concern at the imposition of laws and other forms of coercive economic measures, including unilateral sanctions against developing countries. It said such moves violate the UN Charter and undermine international law and the rules of the World Trade Organization. The 120-member movement stated that the objectives of sanctions are not and should not be collective punishment of ordinary people. It noted that sanctions regimes should avoid inflicting unintended consequences or depriving civilians of humanitarian assistance.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The National Endowment for Democracy can claim it is in the business of democracy promotion. In reality, it does anything but that, unless democracy is entirely synonymous with elite U.S. interest. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Alan McLeod, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Documents Reveal U.S. Government Spent $22 Million Promoting Anti-Russian Narrative in Ukraine and Abroad. Stay tuned for the second part of this article, please. The National Endowment for Democracy, NED, has been training political leaders. Other arms of the U.S. government have been training military units, almost certainly including the notorious neo-Nazi group, the Azov Battalion. A Yahoo News report noted that since 2015, the CIA has been training insurgent leaders while U.S. Congress rubber-stamped hundreds of millions of dollars worth of military aid to Ukraine. The congressional aid bill originally included text explicitly barring assistance to Azov, but under pressure from the Pentagon, the language was removed. Given all this, wrote Jacobins Branko Mercedic, it would be more of a surprise that the neo-Nazis of Azov haven't been trained in CIA's clandestine make an insurgency program. In the drive to stoke hostilities between the West and Russia, corporate media have overwhelmingly ignored the fact that the US and NATO forces have been supporting openly neo-Nazi paramilitaries for many years. The Western media also omitted that recent unity marches in Kharkiv and Kiev and a staged training of civilians, including a grandmother, were organized and led by the far right, in particular the neo-Nazi Azov battalion. The Azov publicity stunt involving a grandmother, to which Katachonsky is referring, was a particularly noteworthy incident. Conducting a civilian training operation in the middle of the Donbas city of Mariupol, while a crowd of Western journalists looked on, Azov units showed locals how to use rifles. The extraordinary image of a silver-haired 79-year-old babushka staring down the sights of an AK-47 went viral around the world, allowing the media to construct an "everyone in brave Ukraine is doing their part to oppose an imminent Russian invasion narrative." The story was covered by a host of outlets, including ABC News, MSNBC, Newsweek, the BBC, The Guardian, and the Financial Times, as well as by media in Ireland, Australia, the occupied territories of Palestine, Denmark, Thailand, and Indonesia. Images from the training day featured on the front cover of 6 national British newspapers on February 14th. This was all despite the fact that Wolf Sangil in Singa, of the many Azov soldiers instructing the grandmother, is clearly visible in a number of images. The Wolf Sangil was the crest of the infamous SS brigades, Hitler's elite paramilitary units that carried out the extermination of millions of people, including countless Ukrainians, in Nazi death camps across Europe. The image is widely used by neo-Nazi groups in the US and is considered a hate symbol by the Anti-Defamation League. Azov original commander, political Andriy Biletsky, has stated that he sees Ukraine's mission as to lead the white races of the world in a final crusade against Semite-led subhumans. None of the outlets above mentioned the fact that they were profiling neo-Nazis. Judging by other pro-Nazi coverage, this was far from an honest oversight. In 1990, the US government promised Soviet Premier Mikhail Gorbachev that NATO would stray not one inch eastward from its current position in exchange of Soviet support for German reunification. However, it later reneged on this promise, and between 1999 and 2004, NATO galloped eastward, even admitting 3 former Soviet republics, all of which share a land border with Russia. In 2008, NATO also invited Ukraine and Georgia to join. For Moscow, this was an existential threat. Russia, as a country, draws its origins from the Kievan Rus Federation, a medieval state whose capital was Kiev and from where the word Russia derives. In the 13th century, the Rus people fled north towards Moscow to avoid the Mongol invasion, helping to establish the Grand Duchy of Muscovy, which later became the Russian Empire, the Soviet Union, and the Russian Federation today. Putin himself has said he considers Russians and Ukrainians to be one people. Ukraine literally means borderland in Russian. Yet White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki recently described Ukraine as our eastern flank, an assertion that is significantly less credible than Russia's claim. The US-Russian relationship fundamentally deteriorated during the 2014 Maidan Revolution. President Yanukovych had been playing the European Union and Russia off against each other, negotiating economic deals with both. Unsurprisingly, given Ukraine's importance to Moscow, Russia offered a more lucrative deal, which he accepted. This turned out to be Yanukovych's political death warrant, as the United States immediately began supporting a nationwide protest movement. Senior U.S. officials like Senator John McCain and Assistant Secretary of State Victoria Nuland flew to Kiev, famously handing out cookies to protesters in Independence Square. In February 2014, leaked audio of Nuland speaking with U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine, Geoffrey Piat, showed that the United States was pulling the strings and crowning the kings. I don't think Klitsch should be and should go into the government. I don't think it is necessary. I don't think it is a good idea. Nuland can be heard saying, referring to the boxer-turned-politician Vitaly Klitschenko. I think Arseniy Yatsenyukovych is the guy who has got the economic experience, the governing experience, she added. Less than 1 month after the audio leaked, Yatsenyukovych became the next prime minister. Less than 2 weeks after the phone call, snipers massacred almost 100 people protesting. Although the U.S. immediately blamed Yanukovych administration, another leaked audio call, this time between the EU's foreign affairs chief and the Estonian foreign minister, revealed that they believed pro-U.S. forces had staged a false flag attack as a pretext to remove Yanukovych and stage a coup. In the end, far-right militias like Azov and right sector provided the muscle to force Yanukovych out of office. However, as Katochonsky noted, very little of this context is given in the press, leaving audiences fundamentally ignorant of the basic facts. In Katochonsky's opinion, the Western media coverage of the escalating Ukraine conflict is highly inaccurate and selective. The Maidan massacre, which led to the current conflict, is either omitted or misrepresented, even though overwhelming evidence shows that this crucial mass killing of the protesters and the police was perpetrated by the elements of Maidan opposition, in particular the far right. Such evidence includes videos of snipers in Maidan-controlled buildings shooting the protesters and the police, testimonies of the absolute majority of wounded protesters at Maidan massacre trial and investigation, several hundred witnesses and 14 self-admitted members of Maidan snipers groups. All over the world, the National Endowment for Democracy is training groups of people who can function as leaders of another color revolution. In the process, it helps squash genuine grassroots movements by co-opting them and using its financial clout to push activism down pro-U.S. avenues. Spending more than $22 million on the country, NED has made Ukraine one of its top priorities. Yet, an analysis of the groups receiving money reveals that the whole operation is an attempt to shore up support for the U.S.-backed Zelensky administration to carry out a foreign interference operation, the extent of which blows anything Russia is accused of out of the water. The National Endowment for Democracy can claim it is in the business of democracy promotion. In reality, it does anything but that, unless democracy is entirely synonymous with elite U.S. interest. Thank you.
Food for thought.
Hello, everyone. Let us ponder today on how to dress in public, as expounded to us by the embodiment of dignity, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him. He whose dress is chosen by knowledge will have his defects screened from people.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
وَقَضَى رَبُّكَ أَلَّا تَعْبُدُوا إِلَّا إِيَّاهُ وَبِالْوَالِدَيْنِ إِحْسَانًا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytan al-la'in al-rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. We are looking at human rights and justice being one of the main components and ingredients of human rights. it deserves to be mentioned. And human rights and justice, they are the concepts that are currently in the hands of the rulers and the governments that leads people. And such notion of justice needs to be applied by them, even though we as subjects or as citizens or as commoners or people between us, normal people, we also have to apply justice to one another on a lower scale. But when it comes to government, when it comes to leadership, how should they deal with the concept of justice? How should they deal with their own subjects? Now, we are looking at justice from the perspective of Amir al-Mu'mineen being the hero and the champion of justice himself. According to the commander of the faithful, it is not proper for a khalif, for a king, for a leader, for a government to seek distance from their subjects, which seems to be the fact in almost all governments and all kings and leaders and rulers. They seek distance to be proud and haughty, and, you know, they ignore the needs of the people. That's how we see it play now. Now, leadership and power and khilafah or what have you, it means the ruler, the parties in power, they need to associate themselves with people because they are by the people, for the people. That's how it works. So not to distance themselves, but to bring themselves to them. They need to associate themselves with them by showing kindness to them, by behaving with them in a kind, merciful manner, because a government or a leader or a president, their job is to serve the people, to serve their objects and their subjects and what have you. If the ruler remains aloof from the people, none of his excuses and arguments can be accepted. Not to people, not in the sight of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Because simply that position of power, of government, president, ruler, khalifa, what have you, this position, it means it's a position to serve the people, as simple as it could be. It's a position for them to establish justice for the people. It means it's a position to help maintain and create human rights. Now, we see this evident in the rulership of Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, but we never see it in any other khalifa, in any other king, in any other president or government's rulership. Only Ali alayhi salam applied that, where he brought himself down to people, associated himself with the people, and he said, I am here to serve the people. And he said the greatest honor a person could achieve is by serving the creation of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, which is the people themselves. Let us take a break and we continue right after.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program for humanity coming to you from IRIB English Radio. Now, when Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi brought the notion that the government and those who are in power need to associate themselves with the people, that if the people are annoyed with the ruler on account of things, you know, him being bad and him oppressing them and him not giving them their rights and taking everything from him. And I don't think I need to give you examples of that. If you look back into history, you see that it continues. And if you look at now, you can see the trend also continues of how kings and powers and governments and presidents have been oppressing their people. Sometimes they oppress them by being straightforward dictators, and sometimes they do it under the notion of democracy. They call themselves democratic, and they call themselves upholders of freedom and human rights, but in fact, you see that people are suffering. And I wish that you could name me a country that have not oppressed their people in a way or another, even the countries that seemingly and apparently seem to be off, better off than other countries. You can see that there's always a place where those governments are in fact oppressing people in a way or another. So what happened is the people will become annoyed by these leaders, and they become a burden on those leaders, especially when you see, for example, in our modern day, where people go to protest against the oppression and the things that are forced to do against their own will. And you see, when people come out to the streets, it becomes a burden for governments. Sometimes these people get welcomed by life rounds, right, life bullets. And sometimes they get outcasted, sometimes they get imprisoned, and what have you. You know, sometimes they might get lucky and nothing happens. But nevertheless, they become a burden on those government, on those rulers. And the rulers themselves and those governments, they also become a burden on the people because justice and their rights are not given to them. So the commander of the faithful, he himself has highlighted that in his words. And obviously, he tried to apply the fact that he should not be a burden and people should not be a burden on him by giving them their rights. He said, "The hearts of the subjects are the treasury of the ruler." So the ruler himself, all he has is the hearts and the minds and the pleasure of his subjects. And Amir al-Mu'minin continues and he says, he will get from there what he places there. So whatever the ruler puts in the hearts of the people, this is what he reaps, this is what he gets. Whether it would be equity and justice or cruelty and oppression. If the ruler establishes equity and justice, he will get people that respects and obeys him. If he puts cruelty and oppression in their hearts, in return, he will see disobedience and he will see chaos. That's how it works. Because we as people were programmed by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to live in a world where our rights are given and justice is applied. We'll leave it here and we will continue in episodes to come. So until then, stay with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. اللهم صل على محمد وآله 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 Cultural news, social news, scientific news, artistic news. With the light.
Hundreds of Pakistani youths have flown their kites from rooftops in the city of Rawalpindi, celebrating an ancient tradition despite a ban imposed on the festival. People buy or make their own kites to participate in the festival, marking the arrival of spring. Local fairs are also held on this day, where families meet and vendors sell food and decorative clothing. Many people wear different shades of yellow to welcome the new season. The festival can become competitive too, with kite fighting battles. In pursuit of victory, some kite flyers started using powdered glass of metal or metal on their kite strings to cut down other kites. The event was prohibited in 2007 after a slew of fatal accidents. The 37th edition of Fajr International Music Festival has wrapped up with an awards ceremony. During the annual event, music bands from Iran and the world took to the stage to perform their tunes. Yusuf Jalali has more.
From Iran's genuine traditional music to Italian tunes and Afghanistan's Qawwali music, music bands from many parts of the world have been performing on the stage of Iran's Fajr Music Festival. The 37th edition of the week-long event now came to an end with an award ceremony in Tehran, with best music performances cheered and awarded.
In the past 2 years, when the pandemic has cancelled concerts, my team focused on producing albums. I produced 3 albums, and one of them, titled Prime Meridian, won the award tonight.
Fortunately, I won the award for Best Composer tonight. I'm so glad that I was recognized and my work has been seen and appreciated in Iran's most prestigious music festival.
Italian jazz pianist Giovanni Guidi Egyptian oud virtuoso Mohammed Abu Zikri and German pianist Moritz Ernst were among the participants who performed during the festival. As the host, Iran had a strong presence, with pop, classic and traditional music ensembles performing in the festival. Music bands say Fajr Festival is one of the most ethnically diverse music events, where musicians with different nationalities can enjoy each other's performances.
No nation is at war with any other nation. It's the politics that imposes wars and divides nations. Now, such festivals help different nations to come together and listen to each other's music. This definitely bridges the gaps caused by politics.
Fajr International Music Festival is held as part of the nationwide celebrations in Iran, marking the victory of the 1979 Islamic Revolution. After a 2-year hiatus, the 37th Fajr Music Festival was held in person, but with a limited capacity amid the spread of the Omicron variant of the coronavirus. Fajr Music Festival offers a rare chance to listen to live music performances from different parts of the world. And this is where music transcends boundaries and interconnects nations, as it is a universal language that everyone can feel for and enjoy, no matter where they come from. I'm Yusuf Jalali in Tehran.
History shows a gun barrel never stops people from acquiring their learning tools. A bookshop in the besieged Gaza Strip is a testimony, as book lovers flooded the store months after it was flattened in an Israeli airstrike. The new Samir Mansour bookshop, funded by an international donor campaign, now stands some 200 meters from its original site. It was destroyed by an Israeli airstrike on the west of Gaza City last year. The new shop is spread across 2 floors and is stocked with some 400,000 books. They range from school texts to the Quran to Arabic translations of European literary classics. Hundreds of people, including writers and Palestinian officials, attended the bookshop's reopening. The store first opened its doors 30 years ago and is considered the oldest and the biggest in Gaza.
The City of London usually welcomes arts and culture from all over the world, including Iran. In our next report, Bianca Rahimi will be taking us to a performance that fuses music from across the East.
A dream has become a reality. The Conference of the Birds, composed by the brilliant young musician Mehsan Marvasti and inspired by a poem of the same name written by poet Attar of Nishapur in the 12th century, performed here in London. It's a story all Iranians are familiar with, about an epic journey to find the Simurgh.
The Simurgh is to the east what the phoenix is to the west, a mythical creature that symbolizes transformation. And the story of the Simurgh is a spiritual one, full of courage, determination, and self-discovery.
Well, I think it's the first time I've seen so prominently advertised a non-Western musical traditional concert. And I've got a long-standing interest in music from the different parts of the Islamic world. It kind of evokes sort of deeper feelings, spiritual feelings. And the fact that this specific concert is about kind of a spiritual poem, it taps into something which I think a lot of us are looking for, especially in this post-pandemic, current pandemic situation. We're looking for some deeper meanings. So I think it will be striking a chord for a lot of people.
It's a mix of fusion of different music, and that's always interesting, and it's Eurasian music, and it uses different instruments from across Asia to represent birds, and it just sounded lovely.
Even though there are differences, cultural differences between these places and these peoples, and those differences should be recognised in general, that through things like music and art, there can also be synergy, and like, yeah, things can work together as well.
5 years in the making, the Conference of the Birds, conducted by Farnoush Behzad, brought together musicians and instruments from across the world. It fuses Azeri, Chinese, Indian, Arabic, Afghan, Armenian and Persian music, brought to the audience by a Western orchestra. The performance was accompanied by two elocutionists who narrated the story and animated clips of birds and their migratory lives. The art and culture of Iran needs no introduction, renowned worldwide. But young Iranian artists living far from home are always looking for ways to capture the spirit of their homeland and offer Western audiences a taste of Iran. Bianca Rahimi, London.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Axolotls are unique Mexican amphibians at risk of extinction, and many conservation programs are now trying to save these strange-looking animals. An ecological park in Mexico City is the latest place to celebrate them. It has held a ceremony for releasing baby axolotls into their natural habitat, which is the mud. These amphibians are so special that even a number of city officials attended the event. Conservationists say having a clean environment is key to their survival.
I've managed to breed up to 22,000 axolotls. In all of Xochimilco, there are 90 axolotls across 90 kilometers, but the quality of the axolotls depends on the quality of biologist you are. Bad quality water has killed anywhere from 12,000 to 15,000.
Researchers have discovered that axolotls can absorb oxygen from the surface of their skin and are therefore more vulnerable to dirty water and environments. More than 70 breeding centers across Mexico have joined the rally of saving these critically endangered species. Many are even marketing them as ideal pets. But to animal advocates, keeping axolotls as pets is a definite no-no.
A Now, for those who are interested in archaeology, the remains of 14 mummies have been unearthed at an ancient site in central Peru. The mummies, believed to be over 1,000 years old, include 6 children and 8 adults. The tomb containing the bodies was found at an archaeological complex about 25 kilometers from the capital, Lima. Researchers discovered other objects such as clay pots, decorated calabashes, and some knitting gears near the mummies. They believe the children and adults were sacrificed in honor of a prominent local figure whose mummified body was found last November in the same area. Van Dalen says the discovery provides them with the oldest evidence of child sacrifice associated with the burial of an elite character in the pre-Inca era. The city of Cajamarquia, which was built out of mud in around 200 BC, is considered as one of the largest archaeological complexes in Peru.
A miniature bull in Germany's Bavaria is proving that size does not matter, as the small bovine makes himself comfortable in his new herd at an animal sanctuary. This tiny bull had a lucky escape and was rescued from a farmer who was taking him to a slaughterhouse. The mini cow is named Napoleon and was born with a genetic defect. Just 8 months old, the diminutive bull has already reached his full size. Napoleon might be small, but he is mighty and daring, as he is not afraid of joining a herd consisting of big and huge animals.
Napoleon belongs to the Dexter breed, which produces rather small cattle anyway. They grow up to be about 1.2 meters. With his 80 centimeters, he's of course far below that. Despite his size, he feels like a complete bull and is in a good mood. He has settled in with us very quickly, which we are very happy about. He also has a lively effect on the herd.
The little bovine now lives with 100 other rescued livestock. His rescuers say he gets along with other animals and has already become friendly with another rescued cow. The Dexter is a breed of cattle first originated in Ireland. They are usually bred for high-quality meat and milk. An Indonesian man frees a crocodile of a tire that was stuck around its neck some 6 years ago. Tilly, a self-taught rescuer and resident of Central Sulawesi province, captured the reptile and cut the tie using a small saw with the help of some locals. The animal had been too smart to be trapped. Tilly says he had been tracking the reptile for weeks using a basic trap with a rope tied to a log. He used live chickens and dogs as bait to lure the reptile. The crocodile drew the sympathy of local residents who worried the tire would choke as it grows in size. Tilly says his main motive was to help animals, claiming it was not his first experience dealing with a crocodile.
Biologists in Peru release 2 birds back to their natural habitat after weeks of efforts to attend and conserve dozens of animals affected by an oil spill. 2 birds were among some 200 animals found dehydrated and were brought to a veterinary hospital for treatment. Veterinarians, biologists, and volunteers have been leading the cleanup operation of the affected coast close to the capital, Lima. So far, several species have been released after rehabilitation. An oil tanker off the coast of Peru was hit by waves triggered by a volcanic eruption miles away in Tunga in January. Some 6,000 barrels of oil spilled into the ocean that polluted waters and beaches along Peru's Pacific coast.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.